reactance of your coil of coax cable to be a slightly high number compared to 50 ohms. If you could make the inductive reactance 500 ohms or above, then most of the RF energy is no longer going to flow down that shield of that coax. Let me drop. And if you wanted to know what inductance does that, know the formula that inductive reactance is 2 pi FL, 2 pi 6.28 times frequency in hertz times inductance in Henry. And by way of the chapter 4 it's one of the early chapters, maybe chapter 2 of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, there is a formula where if you know the diameter of the coil, then the number of turns and the spacing of the turns, you plug in the numbers to that equation, and it tells you how many microhenries you're going to get. And from the reactance chart, if you're doing it on 80 meters, we'll say, the reactance chart will tell you that many microhenries at 3.7 megacycles is going to give you 500 ohms of inductive reactance. So you can see there's an exact science there, so to speak, if you wanted to literally engineer your poor man's balance. So by way of the poor man's balance, by way of your bypass capacitors, by way of the experiment of unplugging it, you're going to be gaining more and more information. And hopefully you'll come back in a week or two and tell us what you find, Dave. W-A-2-Y-Y-L, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Actually, I was going to ask how many turns and how big, because I figured it should just be the right number of turns and just the right size. That's something I would probably play with gravitatorically. What I would ask you, though, is turns be closer to the coupler or closer to the, and we're talking about 18 months total, not really that far run. And the antenna is very homebrew. It's basically just a wire running out one window around the corner of the building, and that's really about it. But the question now is just really where that coil will be, because that's something that I can use. So, would you wait 2YL?
Yeah, the whole philosophy of that coil, Dave, is that the RF energy flows down the shield until it hits that coil. That coil being a very high inductive reactance on your operating frequency represents the equivalent of an open circuit, therefore the energy can't flow any further. So in theory, the closer the coil is to the antenna, the better. The closer you put the coil to the rig, you've got more and more transmission lines doing the radiating, if you know what I mean, and giving you RF in the shack. So you keep the RF as far away from the shack as possible by putting the coil as close to the antenna, within reason. One wavelength away from the antenna could be good enough, if you know what I mean. When it comes to the number of turns and the diameter of the coil, there is no exact science here. As long as the coil is big enough turns and big enough to give you enough inductive reactance at the lowest frequency where you're going to use the antenna. Let me drop. In my example, if it gave you 500 ohms of inductive reactance at 80 meters, and that's the lowest frequency when you use the antenna, then as you go to higher frequencies, the same number of turns at the higher frequency, the same number of microhenries, is going to be giving you more and more inductive reactance. By the time you get up to 10 meters, instead of it being 500 ohms, it may be 5,000 or 50,000, which is good. So the number of turns is a necessary and sufficient, if you know what I mean. As long as you get enough turns for the lowest frequency, you've got it made after that. With a slight exception, I guess it's possible for, if you had just the right number of turns to 80 meters, the coil itself might hit self-resonance at 10 meters or 6 meters. Very a rare circumstance. Don't worry about that one. So I think you see the philosophy on that one. Back to you for any fills on this information, Dave. To be 2YYL, K2RIW.
K2RIW, W2RYL. Yeah, actually, that did make a good deal of sense. I agree. And I will begin experimenting. So, basically, I think I'm set for now. I got some stuff to try. So I want to thank you guys, and let me let you get on, because I know there were some other people that had questions too. So thank you, and I will be listening online.
Quick comment, Dick.
W in the text net. WA2O.
Yeah, not only are you going to make a quick comment, John, but you're the next guy on the list. KC2WGB. Number one on the runway. KC2RIW in the tech net.
Very good. I'm never used to number one. Quick comment on that poor man's balance. I have found between 7 and 10 turns at approximately 1 foot in diameter for something like RG8 or LMR seems to work very well on the HF frequencies.
Good information. Go right ahead with your question, John.
Okay, well, this is to help pick your brain. I have a 70-foot length of LMR 400, and I have it on my TDR, and it's showing an error at about 23 feet, and it's a severe error. It lasts at 500 megahertz. It's much more severe at 1 gig, and the network analyzer in the TDR mode and the analysis mode is showing the same exact location. There is nothing that I can see on the outside of that cable at that distance. It looks perfect. What do you think could be wrong? What do you think I'm going to find when I open that up, Dick, if you've got an opinion?
I'm a little worried here. Before you open up the cable, which is a destructive test procedure, let's make sure that it's real. You say you have an error, okay? The TDR will tell you that, in your particular case, 23 feet down range on a 70-foot long piece of LMR 400, there's some kind of a disturbance. Okay, what is that disturbance? When you properly analyze what the TDR is telling you, is it telling you that 23 feet down range, it acts like this open circuit? That I could believe if somebody really mistreated the daylights out of the cable. It's possible for the semiconductor to have a break, in which case the TDR would tell you an extremely high jump in impedance, a little bit of straight capacitance, 23 feet downrange. Or does it show you a short circuit or a sudden great big lump in capacitance? And also, depending on how high, let me drop it.
WA2RIY, what a comment.
Joe, recognize, depending on how high you have the gain set on the TDR, it may tell you that 23 feet downrange, you've got a sudden jump from 50 ohms to 55 ohms. If you've got the gain set very high, that'll look terrible. In reality, that's nothing, if you know what I mean. Let's see what Joe, I wonder if you run into things like this, Joe, and when Joe passes it back to me, I'm going to tell you another thing that I think you should do before you start tearing into your cable. WA2YYL, here we go.
Just to make it clear, I also measured from the other end and got the exact length of the same fault at that location. So I did measure both directions, in case you were wondering.
Glad to hear that. What was the nature of the fault? Does it look like a short and open, a sudden lump of capacitance or inductance? What is the nature of the fault that the TDR is telling you? And is the nature, is the magnitude the same in both directions? The number of heat down range is the same, but is the magnitude of fault, what is that fault?
At 1 gig, the fault is almost the same. At 500 meg, there is a difference in the amount of fault. And it looks like I've measured many cables that were crushed, and it looks like it was crushed, but there's absolutely no damage to the cable. So that's about all I can tell you.
Yeah, we've got Joe and Hal in that order lined up on this one. It looks like it's crushed. And it's worse than 1,000 megs to 500. Let's see what Joe's got on this one. DB2RYY, K2RIW, go ahead, Joe.
John said here, what I was going to suggest is that you measure from the opposite end of the cable, see if the fault goes and changes the distance. He already did that. Another thing I would suggest is try operating a different frequency frame, maybe as high as like 1500 megahertz, and see if the if the error becomes progressive or it gets worse or gets a lot less. Sometimes frequency ranges on different cables cause different types of readings. I've had apps up at 1900 megahertz, and you read a different frequency range, it doesn't make it look as severe as it was initially.
Yeah, I think John did say he tested it at 500 and 1000. You recommend that he also test at 1500. Hal? K6DPZ, what do you think it is? K2RIW in the TechNet?
Okay, first of all, what type of cable is it? I didn't hear that. There could have been a pinch in the cable and it came back to its normal feeling, you know, diameter wise. But the inner center conductor and the shield may still be close together, which would cause a problem on the DVR as far as the reflection goes. It's showing up at higher frequencies more predominantly. That's the only I have to make a comment. It sounds like it does have a pinch or a compression, but possibly it went back to its normal size on the outside, but the inside is compression.
Yeah, he said it's LMR 400. In order to pinch LMR 400, which has got a semi-rigid aluminum outer jacket, to pinch it to the point where you've done damage to dielectric and center conductor, and then have it come back to normal. If the polyethylene outer jacket came back to normal, I'm having great trouble believing that the real aluminum outer conductor would come back to normal. I'd like to believe when you run your fingers along that area, you would feel something funny. What's your feeling on that one, Hal? K6DPZ, K2RIW.
WK6DPZ, but remember, the frequency he's taking his measurements, it doesn't have to feel like very much to have a little change to his frequency.
Well, I can say a yes and a no to that one. If you read my little article that's in either Mike number one or Mike number two's website, an article on PL-259 connectors. The PL-259 is about an inch long. And if I was using the PL-259 at 500 megacycles, and yes, it's got something like a 30-ohm input impedance, 30-ohm input impedance, 1 inch long, in the middle of a piece of 70-ohm cable. We really study both mathematically, Smith chart-wise, whatever. The real perturbation that gives you, you'd be amazed how small it is. So just a simple pinch to bring it down to 30 ohms instead of 50 ohms, that's not going to really do much when it comes to the signal flowing down that cable. So when you do walk your hand down to that point, 23 feet downrange on your 70-foot-long piece of LMR 400, and you squeeze the outer black polyethylene jacket, if somebody did pinch that piece of semi-rigid cable to the point where it damaged it, I'm having great trouble believing that that outer aluminum jacket would come back to normal when you couldn't feel it. KC2WGB, K2RIW, over to you, John.
KC2WGB, yes, I also agree. And to do that kind of damage, there should be a scuff mark or something on that outer jacket. And there's absolutely nothing. And I also high-powered the cable at 1,500 volts. There was no arcing, no leakage at all. And numerically, it seems to be fine even when I flex it. So I have no clue of what that could be. So what I'm going to do is I'm taking an area of about 18 inches, strip the jacket off, strip the braid off as I examine it, and eventually take the insulation off the center conductor. And I will get back to you and let you know what I find. It's got to be something.
Comment, John. If that radio, if that cable, in manufacturing, was spot welded, and there was a little bit of an indentation on the cable, possibly you would have a problem where it would have a kick in your reading on the TDR.
That's the thing I suspect, Hal. I think it's the end of mill and where they splice that cable, that center conductor. That might be an issue there. But I'll find out. I'll get to it.
Thanks, and I've got that, John.
Is LMR 400 semi-rigid, or is that a flexible cable? You said the word braid. I wonder if you meant the outer cut. I thought LMR 400 is a piece of semi-rigid with a solid aluminum outer jacket, Have you ever fed RF energy down the cable and find out what comes out of the other end at any frequency, 70 feet downrange, or John? Over to you, John, for those two questions. K2LIW and the TechNet.
EC2W2B. No, actually, I didn't put it in use. I only used my test equipment on it, and that's what I found, and I said, okay, you know, I've got to set it aside, but I wanted to ask you what you thought. I know you've worked with an awful lot of this stuff before I destroy a cable. Well, I could always patch it.
When it comes to opening it up 23 feet downrange, you said you're going to look at the braid. I'm a little bit confused by those words, John. Go ahead.
Comment, K6DZ.
Go ahead, Al.
It's a brand new piece of cable you got from Tesco or one of the other distributors?
Yes, it is a brand new piece of Times.
Let me just go back to them, tell them you ran some tests on that cable run, and it has some deficiencies. Request another piece of cable and don't go crazy.
So this is off a 500-foot spool that I unspooled myself. I can't send the whole spool back.
Is it a braided cable or is it a semi-rigid cable, John?
Braided cable, please.
You bought a large spool, and part of it you checked as a problem.
Okay, now that you did say it's a braided cable, I'm going to agree with you. It's a lot easier to make a pinch in a braided cable, and from the outside it would look fairly normal. And so, once again, 23 feet downrange, your TDR said, what is there? Did it say the impedance jumped from 50 ohms down to 5 ohms? What did the TDR say, magnitude-wise, if you interpreted it that way, John, go ahead.
It was indicating the area of around 20 ohms, 22 ohms, somewhere around there.
And regardless of what frequency you tested it at, in other words, your TDR... I call it the Steinhelfer subroutine. You've got a TDR function on a vector network analyzer, if I understand correctly. And therefore, you can tell it what frequency you want it to do its TDR function. And so, did it jump down to 20 ohms at each of the frequencies you tested it at? Over to you, John.
At 1 gig, the impedance was a little lower, Dick. And first I used my 1503 electronics TDR, which has a fixed pulse frequency. Then I said, okay, you know, let me just check it this way. And I went to the network analyzer and did some runs there. And both of them showed the same error.
Yeah, you've now convinced me it's real. And it's time to open up that cable. And it looks like 23 feet of it is not going to be used with the original function. As long as you've got a 500-foot reel, let's hope the rest of it is good. By the way, out of curiosity, have you ever looked at the whole reel on your TDR, John? Go ahead.
No, I didn't. I should do that. Check the whole thing. Well, now that I cut this piece off, the 70-foot length, and that was defective, there might be a good idea to try that thing. Maybe there's some more spots. But usually, when they weld cable together, it's hundreds of feet involved, so I don't think it'll do it, but it's a good recommendation. I will do that.
So you've got a real machine that's called TDR. Completely separately puts a video pulse, a very fast rising video pulse down the cable, and measures time domain reflectometry. You've also got a TDR function on your vector network analyzer. And I think in the early days, that function, that subroutine, was a fairly expensive auxiliary thing you added to a VNA. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
Yeah, Dick, I believe that function, that option was, I think, about $3,000.
WHYO, another comment?
$3,000. Wow. So, boy, are you well equipped. My goodness. And that's called the Steinhelfer technique. And if you Google the word Steinhelfer, you'll find a bunch of references where they did that. Joe, I wonder how much you've used TDR function on a VNA. To be K2RYY, K2RYW.
than a bathroom experience. They won't tell you if you have like a really, really long left cable, you have to change your frequency. The 1500, 1000, like 2000 in that frequency range. You can try to keep your frequency range low, like say low limit 1000, high limit, low limit 100, high limit 500. You can't get the footage out of it. But here's my question, John. Did you test the cable at a 50 ohm load this fall? Or was the cable completely open? Because the reason I ask this is, I've seen similar things on the Anritsu will display a lot of bumps and things in the cable when the cable at the far end is completely open. And all that kind of stuff goes away when you put a termination at the far end of the cable, 50 ohm termination. It's like images and stuff that's actually not even supposed to, you know, not really there because you got such a high reflection from the far end of the cable. Do you have a cable terminated at the far end?
AC2WGB. Joe, I tried it both with a termination and without a termination. Now, what will happen is, if I use the TDR that's made by Tektronix, it's a beautiful machine, you will see the difference. At the very end, you will see a pulse either rising or falling, whether you have the connector on or off. But you'll see little ripples here and there, but nothing like this. And those ripples, you will also see if you have a connector or a bullet connector in the cable. You know exactly where that bullet connector is. This is excellent. And I just thought maybe there was something wrong, and that's why I went to the network analyzer. But you're right, it makes a difference with the termination or not. But I did both.
I agree with what Hal said. With that type of cable, LMR 400, I believe, has a foil on the inside of the dielectric, the center conductor, and has foil on top of that. And it maybe if that cable has something pressure on it, sat on the cable, not really crushing it, but just, you know, pressure-wise, something leaning against it, the cable may relax and go back to its normal-looking appearance on the outside rubber jacket and possibly the shield, but it bends dollars and dollars. The inside shield itself may not come back to the original shape it was originally because you put the pressure on it.
So you tested it with a termination. That's good. And I guess your next step is to, as accurately as you can, find the exact distance downrange, and then you're going to start slicing into that cable from the outside toward the inside. Is that what you intend to do, John? Go ahead.
Exactly, Dick. The TDR, the Tektronix, tells you, I mean, you're within a centimeter, basically, of an error on a short cable like that. And I will open up, I will skin back 18 inches of that insulation, slowly pick it apart, very careful not to damage that structure. And I'll look at the braid first. I should be able to see if the braid was creased at any severe rate. And then, if worst comes to worst, then I'll strip off the polyethylene or whatever the insulation is on the center conductor. And I'll find out.
Yeah, that's going to be a fun science experiment. And so I was worried that you were looking at a bump from 50 to 55 ohms. If it's going from 50 ohms down to 20, that's serious. Boy, that's hard to do. It has to be foil and or braid that penetrated the foam and is now coming very close to the semiconductor to do that. And it's close to the point of arcing over, although you did say you hypotted it. But you haven't set a signal down it. It'd be interesting to sweep it by putting a signal. Before you cut it open, do sweep it by putting a signal in one end, putting it on your vector network analyzer and sweeping it. And maybe you've already done that. In other words, you're doing the equivalent of measuring the insertion loss versus frequency from one end to the other. Over to you, John, K2IW.
Well, like Joe said, when you're looking at the TDR function, you have to have a specific frequency. I didn't sweep the cable. But, you know, that's an interesting thing to look at, too, because it should show a perturbation there somewhere, and maybe they're above them. But I did try it at those two exact frequencies. Yeah.
Debate for with one more comment about this type of testing.
Go ahead, Joe.
I did a test a couple of years ago, because I had various different types of coax. I wanted to see how much you could really make a piece of cable, how bad you'd have to go, what it would end up being on an FDR type of reading with an Anritsu. I had about 135 feet of cable. I used like an accounting for the barrel in the cable, I terminated the end of the cable, and then took reading the whole thing. Then I took a hammer and beat the crap out of the end of the bad cable. I really had to hit that cable really, really hard. I mean, not where I was flattening, but I mean putting a good ding in it with a hammer in a couple, in like one generalized spot where I started seeing a return loss even starting to approach about minus 10 dB. So it had to get really, really hard. You're talking about, probably something close to that, right? It seems to me like physically that cable really helped me crush very, very bad for to give me that kind of reading back to you.
I agree with you on that one, Joe. Obvious by my study of it on the PL-259, a 70-ohm internal impedance about an inch long in the connector when you made a SO-239, a PL-259, or, a bullet and a barrel put together. And I have personally put 700 watts at 432 megacycles through a pair of those connectors for 10 solid minutes, and it just barely got warm to the touch, and the RF flows through beautifully, even though it's a 30-ohm connector in the middle of a 50-ohm transmission line, because it's only an inch long, which is a 1/27th of a wavelength. The wavelength in air on 432 is 27 inches, so it's a very minor perturbation. You got to be careful how you judge these things. But one experience I had about a year and a half ago, I was watching a guy take pieces of 7/8 inch hardline connector with connectors on the end, type end connectors that were very well installed, and he was putting them on his instrumentation, I'm going to call it. I'm not sure what the instrumentation was, and two of the pieces of cable, he threw them on the ground and said, "They're bad." I said, "Really? How bad are they?" He says, "They're only 29 I said, "What does that mean?" He says, "They should all be 35 or better." He was measuring reflection coefficient. A 35 dB reflection coefficient is something like a 1.03 standing wave ratio. His standard, because he was doing work, a lot of his work he was being done at a, let me drop. A lot of his work was being done at a cell site. And yes, because of passive intermodulation distortion characteristics of hardline cables used at a cell site. One of the beginning tests, not only to measure passive intermodulation distortion 150 dB down, would be to measure of S11, reflection coefficient, of minus 35 dB. But that's an extremely severe test for a non-cell site application. So for him to declare a piece of cable as a minus 29 dB reflection coefficient, when he measured it from end to end, you and I would think that that's a beautiful piece of cable. What do you think, Joe? W-H-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-I-W in the tech net?
I'll tell you something. From working in that industry in the past and putting connectors on those cables, at the end of the day, you would like to see something below 30, but sometimes they didn't go too much below 30. They'd be 31, 32. Sometimes they would be like about 28, 29. I can understand that, but you got to put these connectors on really, really careful to be able to get that kind of reading of 35, 36, 40, at the particular point where the cable is. That's pretty tough to do. You got to be real masterpiece, you got to real work a masterpiece to do that, something like that. Because everything you do for preparing that cable and putting the connector on the end of the cable, everything makes a difference, especially at high frequencies.
But you got to, in our amateur applications, where a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is not good, it's going to certainly disturb the daylight out of your no-tuned HF rig. It's going to trip out into a self-protect mode where it either stops transmitting or goes to a lower power output if you got a 2-to-1 VISWA. But if you did have a rig that had a antenna tuner on it, and you tuned out the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, in the worst case situation, the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is an extra half a dB of insertion loss. And you'd have to do a couple of things wrong even to see the half a dB. So a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, 9.5 dB of reflection coefficient. 9.5. By the time you get up to 20 dB reflection coefficient, which is something like a 1.15 standing wave ratio, for our amateur services, that's more than good enough. I'll admit that some commercial services, that's not good enough. So, where you're going to use it, what it's going to do, makes a big difference as to how persnickety you got to be on that spec. Now, John did want us to look out to see if there's anyone else that wanted to sign in and we didn't give them a chance. Is there someone else that wants to give us their call letters and name because they've got another question for us? Give me a call letters and name right now. K2LIW in the TechNet. Yeah, I didn't think so. And does anybody within the sound of our voices want to give us a couple of words as to what was Ham Radio University like today? When you went to Ham Radio University, what did you see? What did you like? Any suggestions for changes? Give me a call to us right now if you wanted to give us your impression of Ham Radio University at Briar Cliff College. K2RIW listening. These guys get up so early. They're so tired. They're sleeping. And they don't want to discuss it, John. What kind of questions have we gotten this week, John, in your mailbag? KT2WGB. With the mailbag, KT2RIW in the tech net.
KT2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yes, I have a recent amateur here. KT2HUC question on building a linear, an amplifier for his use. Let me let her drop another one with the question. I'd like to know your opinion. Should he build solid state or two? Which one would be easier? And does it make a difference whether it's for HF or VHF? I'm probably going to build one for each, and that's what he's inquiring. Maybe you could give him some tips and tell him where the mines are located. Back to you, Dick, KT2WGB.
Yeah, look out for that minefield. In the case of UHF, 300 megs and above, 432, 1296, the number of tube circuits that are easy to build, not going to give you any trouble, are rather few and far between. The guys that are using tube circuits on 432, 1296, 2300 megs, those are UHF frequencies. Usually it's a commercially made cavity amplifier assembly that maybe it was tuned for 600 megs and they're modifying it to bring it down to 432 or 450. But to start from scratch and build a tube circuit at those frequencies. There are a couple of relatively simple circuits, not too difficult to reproduce, but I'd strongly recommend solid state. In the case of you pick up the right kind of a little bitty pill amplifier, for instance, depending on how many watts you want, some of these little pill amplifiers, pre-terminal circuits, you give it 12 volts, a dropping resistor, input coupling capacitor, output coupling capacitor, and a good layout on a printed circuit board, you've got a fairly nice amplifier that can put out, when you pick a number, maybe 20 or 50 milliwatts, with maybe 10 or 20 dB of gain, depending on which model number little pill you choose. And some of those pills are, $3 bought brand new. Mini Circuits, among other companies, sell things like that. So, if you're not trying to produce a whole lot of power, those pill amplifiers by Mini Circuits can give you a lot of bang for the money. Not a bang for the dollar. You drop them. But now, if you want 10 watts or 100 watts output, life gets very different. At HF frequencies, the advantages of each. If I wanted to build a 100 watt solid state amplifier at HF frequencies, and if I start off with the right circuit, the right, it's most likely an integrated circuit if it's solid state, with the right kind of a layout and balancing structure, you're following somebody's design, which has a reasonably good track record, that could be a fun thing to build and test. To start off as a tinkerer to build a 100 watt solid state amplifier, on any frequency where it's your own design. It's the first time you've ever done that. I don't recommend that. I recommend you find somebody else's design. Almost everything nowadays that you buy is solid state on almost any of these frequencies. So to get on the bandwagon and get experience with solid state is probably the right way to go. Let me drop. There's one exception to that. If I wanted 10 watts or 50 watts output at 10 gigahertz, some of those transistors that can do that are a couple hundred dollars. Yet on the surplus market, I might be able to buy used traveling wave tube assembly, TWTA as they call it, traveling wave tube amplifier assembly, TWTA. I might be able, in some cases, if I'm among the right group of ham radio operators, I may be able to buy that for $50. And the nice thing about the traveling wave tube amplifier, yes, it's at solid state, but it might have 35 dB of gain, extremely tolerant of standing wave ratios, and very broadband. Properly used, a traveling wave tube amplifier, in some cases, can cover more than an octave. You build a solid-state amplifier for 10 gigahertz, and if you tune 100 megs high or 100 megs low, it ain't going to work the same way. It's extremely narrowband, whereas the traveling wave tube is broadband as all hell, very forgiving. So there's pluses and minuses here. But since the world, except for traveling wave tube like thing, at S-band and X-band frequencies, except for those, the world is really going solid state. So except for the surplus market, there are very few tube amplifiers anymore, except for the kilowatt class. An amplifier, an afterburner, so to speak, that you add to your
repeater. Time out.
I'm checking to see, we still got the Eastern input operating. If I'm taking my 80 to 10 meter 100 watt amplifier, and I want to add an afterburner for 500 watts, 1000 watts, 1500 watts peak envelope power, and if I've got the money to go out and buy it, whether you buy solid state or tube, doesn't make a great deal of difference. If I'm going to build it, it's a lot easier to build a tube amplifier, 80 to 10 meters, at the 500 watt, 1000 watt level, to homebrew that. To me, with my particular experience, that would be a hell of a lot easier than building in solid state. So, as you can see, the answer somewhat changes as a function of what frequency and what power and what you really intend to do. So there is no one answer for this one, in my opinion, John. Somebody want to add something to that? Go ahead. KC2WGB, K2RW. Go ahead, John.
WGB. I agree. I think he should try to stick with tubes if he's going to go 100 watt to 1,000 watts. I wouldn't even suggest 1,000 or so, up to 500 watts. Tubes should be relatively easy to find all kinds of plans for it, and people who have done it so many times, I think he would be more successful with that. Solid state, because it's unforgiving, it'll allow the damage very quickly. So, yeah, I agree. I think a tube is the way to go. So, good information. And while we're on the subject, I have another question here. Falls right in with these kickers. When is a linear required, and what is the purpose, and what does it do compared to a regular amplifier? This gentleman wants to know which one should he buy for what function. And so back to you, Nick, KC2WGB.
Hey, at the beginning of your last transmission, John, you said some magic words I completely forgot about. In the case of let's say a 500 watt tube amplifier, 500 watts that you're home brewing, do something wrong where you forgot to connect the antenna. It's an open circuit. Tube will just laugh at you and keep right on going. You make a mistake like that with a solid state amplifier, and the actual transistor itself may be $130. I'm just picking numbers out of the air. And you can wipe it out in 1 millisecond because you forgot to put the load on it when you turned it on. So some solid state amplifiers, depending on whether it's got a real good protection circuit built in, can be wiped out in milliseconds. Whereas a tube amplifier will take it for a long period of time. So when it comes to being foolproof, tubes have got a lot going for them. Let me drop. Now, when you're adding an afterburner, whenever you and I buy an 80 through 10 meter single sideband all mode transceiver, which maybe does or doesn't contain an automatic tuner inside, that manufacturer has done a whole lot of engineering and testing to make sure that when it's being used in the way that he recommends, when you use it under rated conditions, all intermodulation distortion products are going to be, I pick a number, 25 or 30 dB down. That's a fancy way of saying when somebody listens to that single sideband, it's going to sound fairly clean. And if you're operating during a contest operation, let me drop it. And your particular ham club and another ham club are both sharing the same top of a mountain, and whether or not your intermodulation distortion and splatter flows outside of your frequency region, you're tuned to 3.7 megacycles. The other ham club is operating in a QSO right now at 3.85, and as long as you've got clean rigs, those two operations inside of the same ham band, where those two tents are mounted 500 feet apart, no problem. But if you've got a very nonlinear amplifier that's making a whole lot of intonation, intermodulation distortion, and splatter, and yes, you are transmitting a signal at 3.75, but the signal you're transmitting is 100 kc wide, and it's wiping out his receiving capability at 3.85, you're going to make yourself unpopular real fast in that environment. So when you're adding an afterburner to a known good design rig, you'd like that amplifier to have the capability of meeting a reasonable amount of linearity. That's a fancy way of saying that, let me drop it. If I do a properly equipped two-tone test, putting two tones simultaneously into that microphone circuit of the exciter, the 80 to 10 meter sideband rig with 100 watts output, and then the output of that rig is going into this 500 watt or 1,000 watt afterburner, and now I'm testing linearity by doing a two-tone test, I'd like those intermodulation distortion products to be, let me pick a number, 25, 30 dB down when it's set at the 500 watt or 1,000 watt output rating. So linearity there makes a lot of difference as to how clean the signal will sound when other people are listening to what you're transmitting, and whether or not you're going to be creating an awful lot of grief for other operations that are within a few miles of where you are. Even if it's not a contest, if another ham radio operator in your town, 3 miles away on the other end of the town, is being splattered by your very nonlinear rig, he's going to be saying some strong, salty language about your operation. So in a situation like that, linearity could be relatively important. Let me drop. And to get that linearity is a function of at least two things. One, starting off with a design that's capable of delivering that linearity. And second of all, you properly align the rig. I can take a rig that's capable of making 500 watts output, all intermodulation distortion products, of 30 dB down, and I twist the knobs on the front panel of that rig in the wrong way, I can be making some pretty weird splatter and very nonlinear signals. So linearity is a function of the design that's capable, and you've properly set it up when you've aligned it, when you've tuned it up. KT2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay. Now, can both of those amplifiers be used on all bands like FM, single sideband or AM.
Oh, with a linear amplifier, the most severe environment is to reproduce a single sideband signal. The reason I say that is that when the single sideband transmitter is working correctly, and at the instant that I'm paused and I'm not speaking any words into the mic, even though the rig is in the transmit mode, in theory, it is not putting out any more power than a few milliwatts during the time I'm not speaking into the mic. And then when I speak into the mic, out comes bursts of 100 watts out of the exciter rig and maybe 1,000 watts out of the afterburner. So you can see that's an extremely severe environment. I want the amplifier to be thoroughly linear from the milliwatt level up to the 1,000 watt level in the case of that afterburner. So to stay linear across that power spread requires some good engineering and some good alignment. Let me drop. Now, if I'm using that transmitter as a FM transmitter, the word linearity has a very different meaning. An FM transmitter means that the low-level modulator way back in the exciter is properly being fed audio that's gone through the right kind of a speech processor in order to set up the FM modulation to have the right amount of pre-emphasis to sound good. So FM has a very different word for linearity. The final stage of the transmitter could be running Class C, very nonlinear. But if it's being used in FM service, that's very acceptable and very high efficiency, by the way. One of the things you got to worry about, though, is that FM service is keyed out. By that I mean, if I'm using that amplifier with a 1,000-watt output capability and it's rated for 1,000 watts with single sideband service, where I'm speaking into the mic with a certain duty factor and there's pauses in my speech, and the amplifier gets a chance to cool off a little bit between those pauses. Can I drop? I'm now trying to set that amplifier to run 1,000 watts output, key down, FM service. I could very easily overheat that final stage because it's not made for that kind of duty factor. If I transmit for 60 solid seconds on FM, an amplifier is running full blast power for 60 solid seconds, which is very different compared to single sideband, as far as the amount of heating of that final stage is concerned. So, now Morse code is something in between. In the case of transmitting Morse code, the good news is you're not holding down the key for long periods of time. You're letting up periods of time. The good news. Bad news, depending on how you set the keying circuit and the linearity, you could be, if I took a Class C high power amplifier, which in FM service would be very efficient and work like a charm, but I now use it for sending Morse code or sideband. Oh boy, is that going to be making, in the case of sideband, it's going to be making lots of distortion because it's a Class C final stage. You take, for instance, your Mirage amplifier, which in FM service does a beautiful job, and if you don't modify the daylights out of that circuit, let me drop this. Your Mirage 100-watt solid-state amplifier, 160-watt, 2-meter solid-state amplifier, you put single sideband through it, it's going to come out with a lot of distortion, unless you make a lot of modifications for it. It is not intended to be a sideband linear amplifier. It's a Class C afterburner for FM service. Another point I was going to make along these lines. I'll send it back to you, John. Maybe I'll think of it. KC2WGB. Oh, yeah. T-Clicks. That Class C final stage could be making some pretty strong key clicks when I'm using it for Morse code. So you'd like to have a nice gentle shape to the rise time and the fall time of pressing down that key and releasing that key in order to make clean sounding single sideband that doesn't splatter and make your signal 100 kilohertz wide. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good information, Dick. I'm sure that helped him make up his mind on what to buy, because he spends the money. He doesn't want to make a bad investment. So if he has any further questions, he can mail, and I will ask next week. He's
wants to get it for the summertime use, and he also wants to make it portable so he can take it on his vehicle. Okay? And that should be a lot of fun. All right, let me let it drop, and I've got one more.
Yeah, I'm going to add a couple words to this one, but this is my personal opinion. Every piece of electronics I own was bought used. The rig you're listening to right now is a Kenwood 711A, TS711A Kenwood. It's a 2-meter all-mode rig, at least 144 to 148 megahertz, sideband CW, FM, upper sideband, lower sideband, all kinds of modes. And it is probably 1985 vintage when it was brand new, and it's got an extremely good synthesizer, only 30 memory channels, but in many cases that's more than enough. Rather clean rig with built-in 110 volt power supply. Feed 12 volts into it, or 110 volts. It's almost compact enough you could use it mobile. It's a lot bigger than a normal modern-day mobile rig. Makes a very good base station rig. And on the used market, in fairly good shape, it's a rig that's got a lot of track record. You could buy that for $300. The equivalent today of that rig is a healthy $1,500. The $1,500 rig doesn't have that many more horns and whistles than this $300 rig. So as long as you can buy a rig that has a known good track record, as long as you have access to people, let me drop it. As long as you have access to people like Al K6DPZ, Andy DeBay2CDL, people who know how to fix equipment, or as long as you've got the right attitude yourself and you're willing to learn how to do repairs if need be, you can save yourself an awful lot of money by buying a used piece of equipment that has a known good track record as opposed to brand new. It's nice to get a brand new rig with all the plastic wrappings and a nice brand new smell, but you're going to pay a lot of dollars for it. And in some cases, as soon as you open that box, in some cases that rig has just become $500 or less valuable because it was brand new. It's sort of like buying a brand new car. When you drive it out of the showroom, in some cases the car is now $500 less valuable than before you drove it out of the showroom. Whereas you buy a used car, it doesn't depreciate anywhere near as fast. That's an opinion. Everything I own is used. KC2WGB, KQRIW in the Tech Rant.
Yes, I agree, Dick. Used carries, they give you a great advantage, because even if you buy a radio that's like yours, it's over $1,000, okay? You buy it used for even $400, and even if you have to put $200 into it to bring it back to working condition, that's a big advantage, and it does buy you, whether it's test equipment or radios. I have a few new, and I have a few used, and I'm happy with both, but you do pay more for a brand new, without a doubt, just like a car. Kind of silly to buy a new car, I don't do that. All right, let me let it drop, I'll go on to my next one. Did you hear me over that, Dick?
All is well. Please proceed.
Okay. I have a gentleman I've been helping out with horn designs and builds a lot of microwave horns, and he's working between and 20 gig. Now, his question is, I taught him how to do the patterning because he was doing individual things and soldering them together. I mean, it was a mess. So I taught him how to lay out the pattern in paper form so that he could make something that was foldable and build the horns that way, and he's very happy with that system. But what he's asking now is it possible for him to design a horn out of cardboard or foam board and coat it with aluminum foil and hold it up into where the horn, because he built about 7 or 8 horns and he's been using copper and aluminum. Kind of expensive, and it's a lot of work. This would be a lot quicker, but he doesn't know if it would work. So what do you think of that idea, Dick? If you coat the cardboard forms after they were developed with aluminum foil, would that work for a horn? Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
When it comes to horns at 8 to 20 gigahertz, I'm guessing the horns have a mouth that's not much bigger than 3 or 4 inches square, maybe ideal length of about 5 or 6 inches. Am I in the right ballpark for the approximate dimensions of the horns you're discussing, John? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick. They're the type of small horns you see on little stands that you play with, and that's what he's been fooled with. Back to you.
He could get extremely high performance, very inexpensive materials, very easy to build. If he builds them out of copper-clad printed circuit board, he cut it up with tin snips or other kinds of cutting tools. In some cases, you can fold them, but soldering the joints on copper-clad printed circuit board and then paint it if you want to and round off the edges. There's all kinds of things you can do to make it look pretty. You get extremely high performance, very fast construction. Just got to do quite a bit of soldering along those edges. And by the way, to build it out of aluminum, to make all the edges come out right with good conductivity is very difficult because aluminum soldering is so difficult. Has he considered copper-clad printed circuit board? Yes, you can do it with cardboard and tin foil, but I don't recommend it. Depending on how much reliability you want, whether or not you want it to fold up for shipments and things like that, but copper-clad boards give you a lot of bang for the dollar, John. Go ahead.
Well, that's part of the problem. I've also suggested that he gets very thin aluminum sheet material, and you bend them in a break after you pattern them out, just like the sheet metal guys do. Bend them in a break, and you only have one joint to solder, plus the rear assembly horn. And told him about that. He'd like to use foam or cardboard if possible, because he can laminate that with foil, an industrial, like a heavy restaurant foil, metalize it. But that's a good idea, too, with the circuit. I'll give him that suggestion. Maybe he's listening. I hope he is. Yeah, that sounds doable, but a lot of soldering.
Yes, a fair amount of soldering. But that soldering goes very fast if you've got the right soldering iron. That whole soldering operation is 5 minutes worth. Bending sheet aluminum. If you do it with the right kind of a tab where there's an overlap on that one remaining joint, then you're saying you could solder. That overlapping joint could be screwed together, riveted together, and or soldered, and maybe both. But a close enough spacing of screws or rivets would give you 98% of the performance of a completely solid soldered joint in that area. So lots of ways of building horns. A fair number of guys do it with copper-clad printed circuit board. The next question is going to be, should it be single-sided or double-sided? And there's advantages and disadvantages of each. But the horn itself is fairly light, fairly fast to build, not very expensive, out of copper clad. And in some cases you worry about, are you going to get extra loss if you paint it? And the answer is no. I remember when I first built my first couple of horns for satellite reception or Apollo reception on the job. I wanted it to look good, and I knew I was going to spray paint it with black or silver paint, and I worried what was the insertion loss of the paint layer. And if you look at it realistically, the paint is going to be what? Considerably less than a thousandth of an inch. And I was operating at a frequency where the wavelength was 4 inches. So a thousandth of an inch compared to a wavelength of 4 inches is nothing. If I had to make a thousandth of an inch coating of paint out of a lossy material, you couldn't do it. So don't worry about the paint. Unless the paint is there at a joint where it's overlapping and now you're not making contact anymore, that would hurt a little bit. But even that, at microwave frequencies, the overlapping metal is going to give you enough capacitive coupling. It'll still act like it's a solid chunk of metal. In fact, with the overlapping I'm describing in the tab, where the last joint is an overlap and you put screws through it, you don't even have to put a whole lot of screws at very close spacing, because the capacitive